Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Edgy Thinking. This is episode 3 and it's Learning from the Past. We've got a really, really great show for you today. This is totally co-produced between Edge Foundation and FE News. And we're looking around all sorts of different areas of Edge Foundation's expertise. And today I'm joined by Andrea. Would you like to join us, Andrea?
Yes, thank you, Gavin. Thanks, very well.
I'm really excited about. I'm really good. Yeah, I'm really excited about today. It's Learning from the Past project. So I wonder if you can sort of explain to the audience what that's around, and then we can bring in some really interesting guests. We've got Lynn and Sue are going to be joining us soon. But I wonder if you could explain what Learning from the Past is all about.
Yes, of course. No, thank you. We have started to think about Learning from the Past project last year, there is a clear loss of policy memory, and we very often refer to that. And also, we discuss it among researchers, especially when policies are being introduced and reintroduced. So we simply thought that we should do something about it. So we decided to develop a series of reviews of past policy initiatives, either successful or unsuccessful, and reflect on them and consider what lessons can be or could have been learned from them. So within this project, we aim to support the development of policy memory and offer these short reviews to all policymakers, researchers, and practitioners. So Edge runs an early career researchers network to support the development of researchers who are interested in technical vocational education and training. And the members of this network have written the reviews which are available on the website so far. So initially we have planned 12 such reviews that are of interest to Edge. Now the list is growing, of course. I mean, these reviews included policy initiative related mainly to technical and vocational education, and that have been supportive of disadvantaged young people, such as young people not in education, employment, and training. So far, we have reviewed 7 policy initiatives from the past. These include entry to employment, young apprenticeships, technical vocational education initiatives, education business partnerships. The first review was about connections, as independent advice and guidance is and has been an important element that really runs through all aspects of education. So the list of past policy initiatives to be reviewed is growing, as I said, and the future reviews will include, for example, Train to Gain, but we also endeavor to revisit some higher education relevant initiatives and review the national scholarship programs next and revisit the polytechnics. So I do think that learning from the past is necessary and invaluable in order to avoid past mistakes and build on existing or past good practice.
Yeah,
so I hope that gives you an idea.
No, that totally does. And I know we're going to be covering 2 today, and it's sort of looking at the past, but also looking at the now. And then later on, going to be looking a little bit into the future, which is all very much, I love looking a bit into the future as best we can. So what 2 sort of policies of the past are we looking at this week?
I mean, this week sort of focusing on the education maintenance allowance that Sue McGuire has evaluated going back to some years. But on the back of that, she will also revisit some of, goes back in time and revisit some previous policy initiatives as well, like the YTOs and so on. And then the next one that Lynn Rogers is going to revisit is the 14 to 19 diplomas, because that has great relevance at the minute as we are seeing the development and introduction of the T-levels. So 2 really exciting pieces.
Yeah, today. And this is how they link up. So I'd like to introduce in Sue and Lynn. So I wonder if you could join us in the studio. Hi, Sue. Hi, Lynn. So Sue is University of the Bath. Lynn is with UCL Institute of Education. And Andrea, do you want to take it away with Sue?
Yes, no, thank you. I mean, as I mentioned, Sue is going to mainly focus on the education and maintenance allowance that was reviewed by EDGE, and you can see it on our website. But let me ask you, Sue, the first question. What did we learn about education maintenance allowance as an initiative to increase post-16 youth participation, retention, and achievement?
Thank you, Andrea. Well, the EMA remains one of the largest evaluations that was ever commissioned on a pilot program in this country. So it was subject to robust evaluation between 1999 and 2004 before it was rolled out as a national policy initiative across England. And before we started the evaluation, we were set measurement targets as part of the consortium of a number of research organisations. We had to look at the effect of paying young people to learn on increasing participation, retention and achievement rates among young people from lower income families and to increase their propensity to stay on in post-16 education. That measure was reached quite comfortably within the participation and retention measure. So we could easily demonstrate that we could increase participation beyond the 5 percentage point measure. And in terms of the national implementation, obviously we are aware that EMA was wound up in England in 2011. But we should remember that it's not a past policy in the devolved administrations, that it remains an active policy in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland.
No, thank you.
Go, Andrea.
Yeah, sorry, just a follow-up question. So can you tell us a little bit about what was successful and where EMA was less successful?
Okay, I mean, in terms of the evaluation, what was less successful was our ability to measure the attainment effect. And that was for two reasons. Firstly, counting whether people are in education or not education is just counting in and out measures. When we came to measuring the qualification attainment, we were trying to match pilot and control areas against a vast array of qualifications, both vocational and academic qualifications. So the attainment measure was far more tricky to get a measure against. And we were also working against surveys that had the highest attrition rates at that time because we were tracking young people over a 4-year period. So the evaluation found the attainment measure far more tricky. In terms of the performance of the policy itself, we could demonstrate that it was quite clearly successful in engaging and retaining young people in post-16 learning. Where the evaluation showed a weakness was actually re-engaging young people who were NEET and in jobs without training. So what the evaluation evidence showed quite clearly was that paying young people alone was not enough, that we needed different carrots to attract them to participate in future learning. And one of the learning outcomes from the EMA was that we embarked on the activity and learning agreement pilots in 2004, which were targeted much more at those two groups. And as well as offering financial incentives, they also offered tailored learning and personalised support. So we learned a lot about the population beyond the immediate population that the policy was targeted at.
That's really interesting. Can I ask you, EMA is interesting, and particularly as it's running in different nations as well. But like, what early intervention programs can tackle youth unemployment in the UK? In addition to this, and how do you see they measure up to similar programs like now, like say Kickstart? how would you sort of see as a way forward for this?
Okay, so tackling youth unemployment has been a vexing issue in this country and internationally for many, many years. And in the UK, the earliest initiatives were the Youth Opportunities Programme that started in 1978 and its predecessor, the Work Experience Programme, that started in 1976. And they very much relate, as far as I can see, to the Kickstart Programme that we are seeing now. So basically, they were six-month work experience programmes to tackle, at that time, in the 70s, quite small-scale youth unemployment. And what happened was that rapidly those programmes, particularly the Youth Opportunities Programme, just couldn't cope with the volume of youth unemployment that escalated towards the end of the 70s and the early 80s. So they were rapidly replaced by what we all know is the Youth Training Scheme in 1983, which is Margaret Thatcher's response to youth unemployment. So we moved from the 70s from a work experience model, such as the Kickstart programme, to a much bigger youth training programme to deal with the escalating levels of youth unemployment throughout the UK.
That's really helpful, thank you. Can we bring you in, Lynn? You've been very, very patient with us and Sue sketching things out there for us. Andrea, did you want to open it up with Lynn for me, please?
Yes, thank you. I mean, Lynn, I'm asking a very similar question from you as I have done so with Sue. So what did we learn from the 14 to 19 diplomas in relation to, for example, educational reform, employer engagement in qualification development, or strengthening the vocational routes?
An interesting question, Andrea. I'd like to go back a little bit further in time, just to put this in a wider context, if that's okay. Because if we look across England, certainly we have a long history of looking for alternative, meaningful alternative qualifications that will stand up in a par with A-levels, if that makes sense, to give young people a sense of choice and agency, particularly in their post-16 study. So if we go back to the 1990s, for instance, we had general national vocational qualifications, GNVQs, that were designed to be an alternative to A-levels. And certainly at that time, they were quite welcomed by practitioners, partly because of the more practical based types of work that young people did. And actually, in relation to the 14 to 19 diplomas, there was a 14 to 16 part one GNBQ that was also introduced later on. And then if we move forward in terms of the Curriculum 2000 reforms, we had advanced vocational certificates, again, another attempt to provide an alternative qualification to the academic track of A-levels. What happened with that was they made very little headway, partly because of what I might call academic drift, in terms of they became more academic qualifications in terms of, I guess, educational respectability. What you see, though, just looking at those two, if we have some problems that were identified even before we got to the 14 to 19 diplomas. So most capable learners continue to take A-levels. Neither the GMBQ nor the ABC really articulated effective progression pathways for young people in terms of apprenticeships and work-based learning. ABCs in particular had a lack of recognition from higher education or in employers. So if we then move on to the 14 to 19 diplomas, these were slightly different because they were a 14 to 19 sort of progression pathway for young people that was set at different levels, level one, level two, level three. That in extent itself is quite a challenging task, because then you wonder, who are these qualifications for? Are they for disengaged young people? Are they for young people who failed at that time to get five or more GCSEs, grades A to C? Or are these for young people who are aspiring to go to university? What they did offer, though, was a broader framework, another attempt at a middle track qualification that balances academic and vocational education. Young people could study an A-level or a BTEC as part of this composite qualification, and they also had to undertake English, maths, IT as part of that, and work experience was a more, you know, had a more sort of prominent place within that. So there were some positives, I think, within the approach taken to the 14 to 19 diplomas in terms of a more inclusive qualification. There was a level of employer engagement in developing the qualifications, and also they looked to foster a broader sense of learning than focusing on a sort of particular sort of occupation. What happened broadly, though, is that some young people didn't really understand the qualification. It was a really confusing qualification in terms of assessment. All the different components were assessed in different ways, different grading scales. There were challenges with accessibility. And by that, I mean, the diploma was offered along a number of vocational areas, very similar to T levels. So that might include digital construction, hair and beauty, tourism. But the requirements for the sort of placement opportunities, the employer engagement, meant that it was very difficult for young people to have an active entitlement to study those in any part of the country. You know, so if we think about rural colleges, you know, or in larger rural areas, it's unlikely they're going to have the affordability or capacity to offer all of these lines of the diploma. So there was a challenge there. There was also a challenge in terms of employer engagement, in terms of would they contribute as much as they needed to the diploma in relation to the increased amount of work placements. And I think the other thing about the diplomas was that they very much relied on the sort of consortium approach. So what you found when they're in operation were often a college might be leading a group of associated schools. So the schools might do some days in college to do a sort of vocational element and then some time in school. And where you had strong partnerships, those actually worked very well. But a very sort of interesting model when we move on to look at the sort of T levels. I think within that also, some of the colleges were wary about taking on new qualifications. If we just looked at the history that we've just had, they had various new qualifications being put in place. What was it about the diplomas that might give these some sort of longevity, which in reality they didn't have? And also an array of perceptions about, well, what do parents think of these? Do they value these? So the tendency still for young people to follow the sort of A-level tracks that we'd seen before with previous new qualifications aimed to provide a more meaningful sort of vocational and technical offer for young people. One thing I would like to add, and I'm sure you're going to interrupt me then because I probably talk too much, was running alongside all of this has been quite... The BTECs have always existed. And what's interesting about BTECs is they were not a government-driven qualification. These were sort of employment-driven, and they evolved over time. And they have had a sustained presence along with other qualifications such as Cambridge Technicals, which are really valued by young people, really valued by employers, and also have done an enormous amount of heavy lifting in enabling young people to achieve level 3 qualifications and to progress. I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's a really good place to stop, actually, because this is very, very now, isn't it, where people are taking the value of qualifications of been existing and been a part of the education system for a long time, and there's this sort of change that's happening at the moment around level 3. You know, you've mentioned like Cambridge Technicals, you know, BTECs. What can we learn from what you're saying around this stage that we're in right now, where you know, there's decisions being made? Have people really looked at previous policy to see what's happened in the past? I open that to everyone. I just think it's an interesting and very now sort of question, really.
I mean, I think there are some very specific instances in terms of vocational and technical education that will be ever present with the T levels. Buy-in of employers, yes, there's been employer involvement, but a relatively small amount of employer involvement. Some universities have already said they're not sure whether they're going to accept T-level qualifications, so there's another issue there. That I think issues in terms of accessibility. Will all colleges in time run all lines of the T-levels, or will they decide to specialise? Will all smaller colleges or colleges in more rural or challenging locations, will they run all T levels? So is this an offer that's accessible to young people? Employer engagement would be an increasing challenge, more so than previously, partly because of the increased demands for the work placements, which we're looking up to sort of 45 days, although there's some sort of flex around aspects of that. But if you look at that in conjunction with changes to apprenticeships and the involvement of employers in that, if you look at it in terms of the current situation where we're recovering or coming out of the pandemic, there will be all sorts of people wanting of employers' time. So is there the capacity to support that? I think, and this is a personal viewpoint, what worries me a little about is where is the progression for lower and middle attaining learners? Because the T levels are positioned, you know, at a sort of very high level. You know, you have to pass all the relevant elements to gain the T level qualification. Yes, we have a transition year, but it's questionable about how many young people will progress from the transition year into a T level, especially since within further education, most young people are studying level two qualifications. Will the funding exist for them to continue their studies if they wish to progress to a T level? I'll stop there.
I think it's really interesting, and Sue, I could wrap into a lot of stuff that you was originally talking about as well, because there is a bit of a movement at the moment as well, where people are saying if we give people a set amount of budget for education and CPD and upgoing skills, so there's like the skills boot camps, for example, which were on a free, but then there's like this talk of, you know, if we could give people a grant sort of fund for X, or if we could give someone, you know, ask people to go to down the loan route, what could we learn from that around EMA? Is that, you know, you're saying around, was that just because of certain level of qualifications that were delivered, or is it, how do you sort of see the future of that sort of wrapping out?
I think we learned a lot from EMA in terms of being upfront about what young people could get if they participated in learning. And I think that was absolutely crucial in terms of their decision making. I think what we lapsed into when EMA was abandoned in England was a discretionary fund, so that young people who participate in learning, it's up to the whim of individual colleges and sixth forms as to what they may or may not get. And I think that affects the mindset about whether you sign up in the first place, because you don't actually know what you're going to get. So I think there is an honesty around making it abundantly clear that there are financial incentives available to young people, and that they should be easily accessible and not subject to rigorous scrutiny before you can actually get through the door. So I think we learned a lot about from EMA about informing decision making, and crucially that young people and their parents knew that if they were willing to participate in learning, that reward would be there. And it was a something for something initiative. And if they knew they didn't turn up, they wouldn't get the money. So it worked much better, and I think improved attendance and performance beyond what we actually expected.
Yeah, that's really cool. We're nearly at the close of this session. I want to ask about 5 million other questions about previous schemes. I'm about to go. No, I won't. Let's move to the future. What can we learn from? Yeah, we've looked at a couple of different schemes. You know, like Sue, I know you've got different bits of data you could share about Kickstart as well. But I think this move to the future, what can we learn? What can we help policymakers move forward? I think as well there's an element around governments may change, but there's at times when policymakers within, you know, the things like that can maybe sort of be a bit sticky. I don't know if you wanted to explain that at all, Andrea, to audience around the way that sometimes the mechanics of policy works, and then what we can maybe learn from previous policies so we can actually help people with it sort of developing moving forward, if that makes sense.
Yes, perhaps just a couple of things briefly. I mean, one is, I mean, we all know that within government departments, people are moving around pretty rapidly, so they don't really have time to settle in and perhaps look at past. They are very likely preoccupied what's going on at present rather than, you know, having the time to immerse themselves with previous policy initiatives. So we are going to continue this series of reviews in the future. But I think Lynn's and Sue's examples of how diplomas are linked to T-levels, do they, and to what extent, and similarly Sue's EMA and the young training schemes linked to Kickstart. I think these are really excellent examples why we ought to look at past policy developments and why we will have to revisit previous evaluations where there were especially, but equally the diplomas as well, the EMA, they were large scale evaluations of these initiatives. So there was a lot of money being put into evaluating the policy initiatives, which are to some extent have disappeared. Mm. And I think these are really important points to make.
Can I ask, if you had a dream, and you was looking at future policymakers, what would you want to share with them? How can we sort of not just keep repeating mistakes, but learn from what we've done in the past and be able to then move forward? What would you want to be able to pass on to future policymakers, Lynn?
Well, I think what we've demonstrated today is that it's really important to refer back to different policy initiatives. I mean, the ones that I've talked about are successive examples of attempts to offer more meaningful curriculum to young people, to motivate young people, to actually enable young people to stay on in education for longer and succeed in programmes of study that they aspire to follow. And that's laudable and that's great. But there are demonstrable issues and tensions that have been seen for a long time, and these will be ever present within the T-levels.
Yeah, definitely. Sue, if you could have a dream and dream big, what would you want to see next?
Well, I think we've had an eternal problem of policymakers being fickle and moving on, and this is nothing new. But we should learn from previous policies. I would agree wholeheartedly with what Andrea said about we can benefit enormously from previous evaluations that are much better funded than we've experienced through the years of austerity, and we shouldn't throw out that expertise and that knowledge and understanding. And I think as far as young people are concerned, I think the key message is that one size doesn't fit all, that we need tailored policies, we need tailored interventions, and they cost money. And policymakers will squeak and say, that's too expensive, we can't do that. But the answer to that is, what if we don't do that? And we can't and shouldn't tolerate long-term youth unemployment and youth inactivity, and we should offer young people positive interventions, positive inclusion, and that should be without taking out massive loans and debt and everything else, and invest in their futures.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, our time is gone. Thank you so much, everyone. This is totally co-produced. And Andrea, thank you so much for covering for me. The first time ever, I had a technical hitch and you completely covered for me my a little minor dip out. And you can tell we're live. We've got Lynn's cat joining the stream as well. But thank you, everyone, for joining us today. This is totally co-produced. This is Andrea has put this all together. And I hope everyone has found this really, really helpful. Hopefully future policymakers have found this very helpful for the future. This is episode 3. Next week is episode 4, looking at community connected learning with Laura. That's on the 21st of October at 12 noon. And so thank you everyone for joining us today, and we'll hopefully see you again really soon.
Thank you.